Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today we have the best-selling author of Ghost Soldiers, Hampton Sides. He's got a brand new book in paperback on Desperate Ground. Hampton, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
On Desperate Ground, this book taking place during the Korean War. Now, isn't this the Forgotten War?
Well, it's called that, and it certainly is forgotten by large swaths of the population. I think aside from endless episodes of MASH, you know, the Korean War has not gotten the purchase on the national imagination that perhaps World War II or even Vietnam did. These guys are kind of coming to the end of their lives. This is the generation that we're really, I think, celebrating and focused on. I wanted to try to understand that war because it is a war. It was a very much a war. You know, some people say it was a conflict or other diminutives like a UN police action, but it was a war and the battles were epic and terrible and heroic. I think a lot of these veterans are a little bit mystified about why so many people, particularly younger generations, just don't know anything about it. Particularly now that North Korea and South Korea and China are so much in the news these days, that part of the world is every bit as important and fraught with danger as it was back then in 1950. But I found that to write about the entire war was going to be too sprawling a book. I wanted to pick one battle that was kind of like the master key that unlocks an understanding of the war. It didn't take me long to figure out that that battle was Chosin Reservoir. It is a battle that was fought in unbelievable conditions in the mountains of North Korea, in this wilderness, in 35 below zero weather, against overwhelming numbers, the numerical superiority of the enemy, which was the Chinese. Mao and his generals had brought in over 300,000 troops into North Korea, and the U.S. forces, led by the 1st Marine Division, realized that they were completely surrounded by the shores of a frozen lake, the Chosin Reservoir, and they had to figure out how to absorb this onslaught and how to organize a withdrawal. They were going to be annihilated if they didn't. So this is really a story about fighting your way into a situation and then fighting your way out, which they do beautifully. And it's a battle that is celebrated and studied by the Marine Corps because it was done with ingenuity and ferocity, and they got their men out of there, lived to fight another day.
With this book on Desperate Ground, I'm sure that you did a lot of research on this going into it. Do you get a different perspective of this after the research that you did?
Yes. You know, I did a lot of interviews with veterans, and I would say that's the lifeblood of this book, is just getting to know these guys. And it was the fun part. It was the joy of doing it. But I, of course, I also went to the archives, and I went to various museums, and I went to South Korea and just tried to understand it from multiple points of view. I think that one of the things that I came to realize, and the way I have come to think about the Korean War, is that it was a world war that was fought in a very limited piece of geography. You know, it was an ideological war. It was communism versus capitalism. It was democracy versus some form of a totalitarian state. It was China and Russia and North Korea versus the United Nations. And it was kind of the first shot over the bow, I guess, of the Cold War. Like, what is this going to really look like? Are we really prepared to kill each other in large numbers? Do we want it to escalate into a true world war, a nuclear war, over this difference in ideology, difference in how we organize our economies and our governments? The answer was, I guess, yes, we are willing to spill blood and treasure for this ideological war, but we want to do it in a very limited, circumscribed piece of geography. And so, unfortunately, it was the civilians of Korea, North and South, who paid the price, the ultimate price. This was, I guess you could argue, a civil war in a way that the whole world wanted to be involved in. Korea has this long history of having been pushed around by other nations, you know, over the millennia, you know, the Chinese and, you know, the Mongols, the Japanese, the Russians, you name it. Everyone had their way with Korea at some point. Of course, now it's really interesting. You go back to Korea. I went to South Korea with a whole bunch of veterans from the war. And, you know, you see this nation, South Korea, that is thriving. It's dynamic. It's a democracy. I think it's the 11th largest economy in the world, player on the world stage in many ways. It's interesting to see, you know, and the veterans particularly are enormously pleased to see that this place that they last saw maybe 50 years ago, almost 70 years ago, was in ruins. It was smoldering. It was crackling with fires, and just it was incredibly impoverished. And now it is doing so well. So it's I think it was pretty reassuring to the veterans when they saw that, you know, that snapshot from, you know, all those years ago, and now today you see such an enormous difference.
In the opening of the book, we not only see the American troops landing, but we also are introduced to a man that comes across the border, leaving his young sister in the north, and he comes over, and he's living, I believe, with his aunt or a cousin or somebody. It's kind of inspiring, I think, to meet this person and see what his challenges really are. Is that something maybe you talked to some South Koreans, maybe that actually happened?
Mm-hmm. I really wanted to understand this war from multiple points of view. And I think it's kind of typical of military literature that we just talk about the soldiers fighting on the ground. But I wanted to understand from a civilian point of view as well. I found this gentleman actually at a reunion in Missouri named Dr. Bae-suk Lee. This is the person you're talking about, who then was a young medical student. He was from the North. He had risked his life to cross over that 38th parallel to live in the South with the extended family there. And then the North invaded, Kim Il-sung invaded, and his family was murdered, left to kind of raise these orphaned children, and very despairing of the future. And then here come the United Nations forces, the Americans, to liberate Seoul. And he ends up joining forces with them and going back to his home city in the north, and is in the middle of this great battle, the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. It was just wonderful to meet one person whose life story kind of tells the larger story of North and South Korea, which is, it's just one of the great tragic geopolitical decisions that was ever made to draw that line, that arbitrary line across the country. Shortly after World War II, the Allied powers decided to divvy up the spoils of the Japanese Empire, and Korea had been, of course, a colony of Japan. So when they did, they found this convenient line on a map, the 38th, you know, just there it is, nice straight line. And they said, all right, the Russians will take the north and we'll take the south, just like we divvied up Berlin. And we'll figure it out later, and we'll unite this country later. Well, that never happened. It very quickly, these two countries became very different. And in the process, all of these families, you know, millions of people were separated permanently from each other. And, you know, it's one country, it's one language, it's one people, it's one culture. It should never have been divided like that. And so Dr. Lee's story, it's just, you know, you could multiply it probably by, you know, millions, because, you know, the tragedy and the poignance, you know, the poignancy of these stories, of these families that have been separated, just cuts through the culture, North and South. And, you know, even now we in the news, you always hear that the North and South are trying to figure out ways of doing visitations, or, you know, let some of these families at least see each other before they, maybe some of the older ones die. Well, Dr. Lee's story, it really speaks to that dimension of the tale, which is, you know, what this war did to millions of civilians.
Kim Il-sung, he's the
grandfather of the current guy.
Yes. How did his grandfather come to power? And it almost sounded like the same way maybe that Castro came to power.
There's some similarities. Kim Il-sung was apparently a very resourceful and brave guerrilla fighter fighting the Japanese during World War II, and developed a local legend sprang up around him. He was a ferocious part of the resistance. You know, the Japanese were brutal to the Koreans during World War II and prior to World War II. And, you know, there was a colony that was just, they just mistreated the Korean people. And there was a resistance, and Kim Il-sung was foremost in that. And so that was part of it. But early on, he became influenced by the Russians. You know, Russia is very close to North Korea. You know, Vladivostok is not too far away. The Russians began to, you know, at the end of World War II, they began to hunt around for someone who could essentially become a puppet. And he studied under, you know, Stalin, essentially. He deliberately, with Russians, with the Soviets' help, created this kind of cult of personality, you know, the great leader, these huge billboards, you know, he can do no wrong. They would start to say, you know, outrageous, you know, lies about him, like that he could walk on water and that he'd make himself invisible and, you know, all these kinds of stories that only grew more and more embellished over the subsequent generations. You know, now they say that, you know, I guess his son was every time he played golf, it was a hole in one. You know, and, you know, they don't defecate, this family. There's something about them. They're biologically different from all the rest of us. All kinds of crazy stuff that people apparently believe in the North. Well, that all started with Kim Il-sung. And he was, you know, he had this army that was composed of Soviet advisors and Soviet tanks and Soviet artillery. And, you know, it was a much more powerful army than the South Korean army. And in June of 1950, he steamrolled across that border, the 38th parallel, and immediately took Seoul and very nearly took the entire peninsula. So that's why we got involved, to protect this fledgling democracy. And the United Nations very quickly got involved, and you know, it took a long time to repulse Kim Il-sung, you know, back to the 38th parallel and beyond. And there the war might have ended had we not gotten a little greedy. After retaking Seoul and returning the borders to where they were from the beginning of the conflict, we decided to keep going. Keep going north, push all the way to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, and then, you know, keep going beyond that, go all the way to the border with China, Manchuria, the Yalu River. And of course the Chinese were leery of this. They, you know, they, the analogy that's often used is, you know, what would we do if China invaded Mexico and pushed all the way to the Rio Grande? We wouldn't sit back and wait. We would intervene. Well, that's what Mao decided to do. He intervened with hundreds of thousands of his troops in the mountains of North Korea, and they were really good at camouflage. And you know, they moved only at night and hid during the day, and there was almost impossible to spot from the air. So it was, all of this contributed to really one of the most enormous intelligence failures in American military history, because how do you not know that 300,000 troops have come across a border and are taking, you know, taking up positions in the mountains to ambush and encircle your troops, which is what was starting to happen, especially at this place called the Chosen Reservoir, and this frozen lake. At that time, it was just, you know, it was freezing cold, 25 below, 35 below. And it was a trap that Mao had rather expertly set for the American forces. And General MacArthur just didn't seem to believe the Chinese were there. Mind you, in the last few weeks of this process, the intelligence was coming in pretty loud and clear. We were capturing Chinese soldiers, and they were saying, yeah, we're here. We're all over here. There's hundreds of thousands of us. And MacArthur and his staff in Tokyo just did not want to believe this. They kind of doctored the evidence. They dismissed it. They said they're rogue elements. They're not really Chinese troops. Keep marching, go to the Yalu River. It's just probably, you know, MacArthur's had a long and controversial career, some great victories, some great defeats, but this was maybe the lowest moment of his military life, was this intelligence failure that he presided over and allowed to happen, and put all these men, tens of thousands of Americans and other UN forces, in, you know, in mortal danger.
So MacArthur, he didn't get along very well with Truman, I believe. Do you go into the book on that in On Desperate Ground?
Sure. Two very different men who were on a collision course not too many months after the story I tell in the book. Of course, Truman fires MacArthur, relieves him from duty because he was saying all kinds of things to the media. He was being insubordinate to the presidency. He was, at this point, kind of incredibly disrespectful of Truman and talking about dropping nuclear bombs on China and, you know, just kind of speaking out of turn, for a general. You know, when you get right down to it, he was just a general and the president is the president. But during this period that I write about in the book, I do write about the one time that MacArthur and Truman actually met face to face. It only happened one time. And when you think about how these two men, were inextricably intertwined, their fates, they actually only met one time, and it was this very strange meeting on an island in the middle of the Pacific called Wake Island. They flew from opposite directions, thousands of miles to get there. They met on this island just for a few short hours. Scholars are still trying to debate precisely what that meeting was about. It was clearly about the Korean War. It was clearly about, like, what's next? What do we do after we win this war? MacArthur was saying the war would be over by Christmas, if not Thanksgiving. And but there was one little asterisk on the whole thing that Truman was worried about. He asked MacArthur, what about the Chinese? Are the Chinese going to intervene? You know, they have a lot more people that they can put into this equation than we're willing to put into this. He was worried about the Russians too, but primarily the Chinese. And MacArthur's answer to that was, yeah, the Chinese, you know, they're in Manchuria, but they're not going to get involved. And even if they did, it would be a slaughter because we would destroy them with our air force and our superior weapons. And, you know, this was just a guerrilla army. These are, you know, serfs and tennis shoes, and, you know, it's like a bamboo army, you know, just pitiful. You know, this whole idea that we had, this kind of arrogance that we later took into the Vietnam War, this sense of, you know, who are these Asian little people with their little weapons kind of attitude. Well, it's a classic example of asymmetrical warfare, you know, a different kind of army, but an effective army nonetheless was able to inflict huge damage on the supposedly superior modern army of the United States. Anyway, so MacArthur and Truman had this curious meeting at Wake Island. The two men got back in their planes and flew back to their stations, MacArthur in Tokyo, Truman in, back in Washington. And even as they were meeting, the Chinese were streaming across the Yalu River and by the hundreds of thousands. And setting this trap that would result in the Chosen Reservoir battle.
All right, On Desperate Ground, out right now in paperback. You are also the best-selling author of several books. Mm-hmm. Probably the last one before this one was Ghost Soldiers. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Well, Ghost Soldiers was a book about the another episode that involves General MacArthur, not at his finest hour, which was the siege and ultimately the surrender at Bataan in the Philippines during World War II. And then it follows the travails of the POWs on the Bataan Death March in the POW camps in the Philippines. And then finally MacArthur's return to the Philippines and a particular camp called Cabana Tawan that had the last survivors of the Death March, these POWs at this point were diseased and starving and just kind of on death's door. When the U.S. Army learned that the Japanese were systematically executing all the last POWs rather than let them fall back into American hands, MacArthur and his troops landed at Luzon and they decided to send the U.S. Army Rangers behind enemy lines to rescue these men in this prison camp. And so it really tells the story of this rescue and how it's an enormously successful rescue. I think they rescued that night about 513 POWs who were destined to be executed by the Japanese. So a very different kind of war story, but one that has MacArthur kind of running right through the middle of it.
How do you get a, this is a historical fiction, would you say? I mean, because you're looking at different people's lives?
No. I mean, you know, there's different clicks on the dial, you know, of this kind of literature. There's historical fiction is, you know, calls itself a novel, and, you know, you can make up anything you want, but you do a lot of research along the way, of your historical characters. This is narrative history. You know, it's like everything in it is true, to the extent that I can verify it. There's 40 some odd pages of notes, bibliography, notes on sources. What narrative nonfiction, narrative history strives to do is make it read like a novel in the sense of structurally pacing, sense of characters moving around, doing things, not so much in-depth analysis, but more plot. Certainly, you know, borrowing some of the attributes that are more commonly associated with perhaps novels or maybe screenplays, of, you know, cross-cutting different storylines and, snippets of dialogue when you can find a source to base it on, so that it, you know, if you're doing your job well, it reads, it has the flow and the pacing and the, a cinematic sense of being there. You know, so much academic history, unfortunately, has a kind of a well-deserved reputation for being deadly dull, right? You know, it's just chloroform in print. You know, it's just puts you to sleep. And narrative nonfiction really strives to just make it, you know, make have the pages turn, because it's history is interesting, and I think it's more interesting than, you know, it is stranger and also more interesting than fiction usually. So that's what I strive to do with these books.
On Desperate Ground, your brand new book in paperback. Now, not only are you doing books, but also you're involved with a documentary. Is that correct?
Yes, there was a 2-hour documentary that was made about the Battle of Chosin Reservoir on the PBS program, The American Experience. It's called The Battle of Chosin. Of course, it features many of the veterans who fought in this thing. It has amazing footage and amazing photography. I was a consultant to it, and you know, I'm one of the talking heads that you see on the screen. You know, I think in recent decades, people have come to realize and to recognize that this battle, the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, is really one of the classic battles of American history, and it just has all these qualities, you know, the cold and the terrain and kind of this almost classical sense of, you know, marching into a trap and then having to figure out how to absorb this onslaught and then figuring out a way to regroup and march out of there. You know, there's one road in and there's one road out, and they march to the sea where there's this enormous evacuation on the level of Dunkirk that happens. So it's just a great story that feels almost like Herodotus or Thucydides or some classical Greek account. It's one of the most decorated battles in American history. Most of the combat was at night in the garish light of these flares, hand-to-hand combat. People were using knives and shovels and entrenching tools, because the overwhelming numbers, the numerical superiority of the enemy, really forced these Marines to dig in deep and, you know, find resources they didn't know they had to get through this, to survive this, and the cold too. I mean, it just, the cold was a character in this book. You know, cold was this all suffusing presence that they had to deal with constantly, and it preyed on people's minds and souls and psyches. And, you know, they had to fight it. Unfortunately, many guys froze to death. And of course this affected the Chinese every bit as much, if not more, than the Marines. You know, no one should be fighting in these kinds of conditions. In the old days, when armies encountered weather like this, they would, you know, shake hands and say, you know, we're out of here, we'll see you in the spring. And they would go to Valley Forge or someplace like that. But these guys didn't do that. They just kept going until they were, on the, you know, on this collision course, and they finally collided at the Chosin Reservoir.
On Desperate Ground, of course, your brand new book in paperback. If I want to find out about Well, a little more about this book, more about Hampton Sides, and maybe other projects that you're working on, and maybe that next book eventually. Do you have a website?
I do indeed. It's just hamptonsides.com. And, you know, I have, I am working on a new book, which is about the life and times and the third and final voyage of Captain James Cook, the British navigator. His third voyage took place during the Revolutionary War, and it involves Hawaii and Alaska, and ultimately his murder in Hawaii. Things did not go so well for him in his final trip to Hawaii.
All right, well, the book is On Desperate Ground by Hampton Sides, best-selling author of Ghost Soldiers. Hey, check out that website. Hampton brings this book to life. I mean, here you are in the middle of this reservoir, the troops going aboard as MacArthur, from his ship, looking out with his binoculars. And you're going to meet some fascinating people, brave people, and I mean, it's just like you were there. Hampton, thanks.
Great being with you. Thank you.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Hampton Sides, author of On Desperate Ground.